Please help me welcome our speaker tonight, Eileen.
Close. It's Elena. I'm Elena. I'm an alcoholic. Thanks, Tyler, and thanks, Mike, for having me come up and speak tonight. So I have a sobriety date. It's July 27, 2002. Last Wednesday, I celebrated 20 years of continuous sobriety. And, you know, that's not from me. That's from God, AA, the support of my family, my friends, and the men and women that I've met here in this, in rooms just like this, right? And it's amazing. It really blows my mind. But I have a sponsor. Her name's Suzanne. There's no coincidences in AA. We have the same sobriety date. She celebrated 41 years last Wednesday. And I have a home group. It's called WOW, Women Helping Other Women. And it's every Tuesday night in Huntington Valley. It's our fourth location. I've been going there every Tuesday night for the past 18 and a half years since the meeting started. And that meeting has been a huge part of my sobriety, and the women that I've met there, the faces have changed over and over again throughout the past 18 and a half years, but they have become my closest friends, right? Everybody that walks in, my prayer has always been, at the direction of my sponsors, to remain open and vulnerable to new relationships, whatever that looks like, right? I used to get like frustrated when I would, you know, stay sober for a while and other women weren't staying sober, or I would sponsor a lot of women and maybe take just a couple through all 12 steps. And, you know, she said, you're 100% successful as a sponsor and as an example of AA, because every time people come back, you're still there, right? And you're still doing it and you're showing it, showing them that it works. So I'll tell you a little bit about what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. I grew up in Northeast Philly. I am the oldest of three. I have, my parents are happily married. They still go on dates. They love each other very much. And, you know, when we talk about like how, you know, like love could have like kept us sober, could keep people alive, right? Like I definitely had that. We didn't have financial things or material things. But there was not a doubt in my mind that my parents loved me. And, my dad got sober when my mom was 6 months pregnant with me. And she had thought that they were just partying. It was the 80s, right? There was lots of like, drinks and quaaludes they talk about, right? So that's what was going on. And then when my mom got pregnant, she realized, like, this is probably not right, right? They had one car. He would leave for, like, 3 days, you know, at a time, and she'd be making up excuses or not being able to go to work, like, all of that. And his friend, in the meantime, had gotten sober. He had 18 months, and my dad went to a meeting, and he stayed sober since then. He just celebrated 38 years. I have two younger brothers. They're both sober today. One has 7 years. One just celebrated 5. And I've been able to be an example of AA to them, right? Like they tell us to like keep our hands out of the mix. And so many times I wanted to jump in there and push AA down their throats, right? Or take them to a meeting, or I'd be like calling a friend like, hey, Paul really needs to go to a meeting. Like maybe you should reach out to him, right? But I really had to like sit on those hands and just let God do his work and just continue to be an example. So I grew up in Northeast Philly, and you know, my parents had been looking for a house. We used to apartment hop, and they had been looking for a house, and they decided let me play the lottery, and they won like 10 grand. And in the 80s, that was like a lot of money. I mean, I'll take it today, but it allowed them to buy a house in a nicer part of Northeast Philly, right? So I grew up there. I felt different. I felt less than. They wore like Nikes and Gap clothes, and I wore like Pro Wings and Cousin clothes, you know, like always hand-me-downs, and feeling just like grateful to wear a school uniform, right, to be able to like fit in and people not know that like, oh, you know, she doesn't have anything. And I found out like when I got sober, right, I didn't know that these were things that I did, but like putting on masks or like covering up the outside, right, or doing the outside to cover up like what's going on inside, and until I got sober, right, that I realized that. But so I grew up in this neighborhood, and you know, I still have 8 girlfriends to this day that I met like through, you know, my 8 years of grade school and high school. But I had like trauma happen to me when I was like 6 years old. I got in the car with a stranger coming home from the playground. And, you know, it doesn't matter how many times you tell your kids, like, don't talk to strangers. They're like, I'm your mom's friend, get in the car. I'm like, okay. Right? Like, you're, like, naive to, like, evil in the world. And that's not why I became an alcoholic or why I drank and did other things, but it definitely shaped me as a person. I got out of that car about, you know, 5 to 10 minutes later, about like 25 years. And then I went on the rest of my life feeling like it was like, if anyone's, you know, my age or older, you might remember like the Final Destination movies, right? So like I always felt like that was going to happen to me and like I had just beat it for that second. So I'm always super aware of my surroundings, like even now, right? Like we'll be walking somewhere. I'm like, someone's weird over there to the left, you know, watch myself. Like I just always have that little bit of awareness, but it's not like it used to be. So I used to not be able to leave my house. My parents, we didn't have money. Our vacations were my dad, he got sober and started running. I did not. I hate to run. It's my worst thing. I wish that I got that genetic component, but I didn't. So he started running and our vacations were going places to watch him run marathons like New York or DC, Baltimore, Boston. And I couldn't go because I couldn't leave. Like I couldn't be anywhere that was like different. So somebody like an aunt would have to come and stay with me in the house. And so my first relationship with any kind of like God or prayer was I started going to a doctor and a doctor said to me, do you pray? And I said, I don't even know what that means. I'm like 7 years old, you know, like what? And he's like, why don't you like ask God to help you? Because at the time I couldn't sleep. I was having nightmares. I was always kidnapped. But it could be like my next door neighbor or it could be like Frankenstein. Like whatever it was like that was the result. And I started praying and asking God for good dreams and I started getting them. And I started feeling like, all right, maybe I do have somebody like here in my corner, right? I started like being able to go out and make friends, play sports. I was super active. Like I played every sport. I'm not good at any sport, but I played everything. Basketball, soccer, I ran track. I was a cheerleader, swimming, like took gymnastics. Like I just did everything. I like to be like active and doing it. But, you know, I always had, like I said, I always had that feeling of like less than or like that hole in the soul that we talk about, like something's missing. Always comparing myself to other people and I'm not as pretty as this one or I'm not as funny as this one. I don't have any money like this one, you know, all of that stuff. And when I was 8 years old, I picked up my first drink. It wasn't, I didn't become homeless the next day. That took a while, but I picked up a drink and it was Canadian whiskey. I don't think I ever drank it again for the rest of my life, but I drank that and I remember it was me and my cousin, Shannon, and you know, I grew up in a neighborhood where my mom's one of seven. We all lived in the same area, so there was 20 of us, you know, we went all through the same 12 years of school. So it was not uncommon for me at 8 years old to be hanging on the corner with 14-year-old kids, right? That's just what I did. I hung out with an older crowd and a lot of boy cousins, so a lot of guy friends and just like buddies, and I drank. So I drank with my cousin, and I remember just taking that sip, and I can feel it right now in this moment, right? Like I can remember that warmth that went down, and I remember feeling like I like this, you know, and I continued to chase that, and it wasn't an everyday thing. It became an every weekend thing really quick, you know, and it was always like, who's getting beer for the weekend? We're in the woods and just like running around. I have a 9-year-old and a 6-year-old. They don't drink alcohol. They also don't steal my cigarettes and smoke them. You know, like I can't imagine like what my parents like went through, you know, and if they did that, I would kill them. But, it's just crazy, right? When I put myself there now raising kids and thinking about how grown I thought that I was at such a young age. And, you know, so I really just ran around. I just did my own thing. There was no cell phones. Like, I just always was, like, chasing a party, and I showed up to school. I did well in school. I had good grades. I became captain of the cheerleading squad. I was president of student council. I got an award at graduation of 8th grade for the most morals and values, right? Like, these were things that, like, and I can remember them, like, describing this award, and I'm like, I'm going to get this. Like, I'm definitely getting this. And then they called out my name. I was like, all right. You know, like I knew that I was able to trick people. Like, I knew that manipulation. I didn't know what it was called then, you know, but I knew that I was good at that. I knew I could look real innocent and be nice to people's parents and then take their liquor out of their cabinet. Like, I knew that I had that ability at a young age. So I went from, you know, a small little Catholic school to a big Catholic high school, and I was no longer like this big fish. I was like a little minnow, right, in the sea, but I was still able to quickly find those people that drank and partied like I did, right? We could go anywhere in the world, and you can just take a look at a person and know, right? So I got involved in other things too besides alcohol, but it always, for me, like, it began with alcohol and it ended with it. I didn't know that my girlfriends didn't black out when they drank. Like, I didn't know that until I got sober. Like, I thought that everybody drank and they blacked out and they didn't know what happened for a couple of days, and, you know, maybe they went out on Friday and they're 14, they come home on Sunday. Like, I just thought that that was normal. And, you know, I can remember just, like, never wanting to be home, never wanting the party to stop, always wanting more, and making those conscious decisions as a young girl. Like, tonight, I'm going to go home when the other girls go home. But I couldn't. Like, I would be making phone calls for other people to pick me up from here. Then before I even got there, I'm asking for someone to pick me up over here. Like, it just didn't stop for me. And like I said, there were no cell phones. So when I left my house, I just left my house and I was out. And later, right in my life, I found out that my parents would be showing up at all these different houses, just like my mom did when my dad used to go out. My mom would show up at different houses trying to find him. And then they started doing that for me. So I picked up a lot harder things too besides alcohol in my story. And it really brought me down a lot quicker and a lot harder. And things that I thought that I would never do, I started to do. And, you know, I can remember I dated this guy all through high school. He's sober today. He has like 6 months. And it's a true miracle, that's for sure, right? I've been sober for 20 years, so he's been running that whole time. And they even did a whole Nat Geo special on him, a whole hour. Drugs, Inc., right? He had the whole hour himself. But, you know, I remember it came out. I said, I didn't know you were a movie star, right? But that's what happened, you know? We got into a lot of things that, you know, 14, 15 years old that are crazy. And my life just got really bad really fast, and, you know, I can remember, like, I wouldn't show up for school. I just wouldn't go, where I would go for, like, first period and walk out the back door, like, whatever that was. And one time, the school had had enough, and they called my parents, and they said, you know, she's dumb, we can't do this anymore, and unless you get her a full psychiatric evaluation. And they came and they found me, and it was 9:30 in the morning, and I was blackout drunk. And I got in the car, and I said to my parents, I said, I think that I don't drink like everybody else does, right? And at the time, I don't know if I believed that or if I really wanted help, but a lot of times, like, when you're drunk, you say the truth. I thought it was just going to, like, get me out of trouble. So I get in the car, I go home, I pass out, and I wake up. Well, my dad wakes me up, and he has a bag packed, and he said, you're going to Horsham Clinic. And I'm like, yeah, okay. So I get in the car, and we drive to Horsham Clinic. It's like 20 minutes from my house, and I'm trying to, like, smoke a cigarette, and I'm shaking, and I can't even, like, every time I go to ash out the window, it goes flying out of my hand, and it takes like 10 cigarettes to smoke like one cigarette, and then I'm in the waiting room, and it feels like I'm there for 4 days, and I get a cup of coffee, and I can't even hold it. Like, I can feel right now, like, the burn that was going down my arm, and I said, all right, I have plans tonight, you know, like, let's wrap this up. So I don't know where I was going, but I definitely had some plans. So they have this, you know, evaluation that they do, and I'm not going anywhere, right? So they keep me there, and I'm 302'd, and, you know, I'm, like, on the kids unit because I'm a child, and they put me on the kids unit, and, you can't smoke there on the kids unit. And I thought, like, my life was over. Like, what am I going to do for this next however long? So I go there. I don't remember anything really about it. I know that people bring AA meetings there because I have done so, right? But I don't remember any of that. I remember, like, getting my hair braided and, like, talking to some girls. Like, just, I just remember extra stuff. And near the end of my time there, I did meet a guy there, a drug and alcohol counselor. And he said to me, I said, I just want to drink. I said, people my age, like, drink on the weekends and they smoke weed. Like, that's normal. Like, people do this. I know that. And I just want to do that. And he was like, you can't do that, right? And I'm like, what do you mean? I'm like, aren't you supposed to teach me how to do this? So he said to me, everybody gets a certain number of party chips and you just spent yours too quick. And that, like, that saying was, like, what I needed to hear at that time. That, like, made sense to me. I was like, oh, okay, that's okay. So I got out of Horsham Clinic, and my dad took me to a beginner's meeting. It's called Oxus. It's Thursday nights. It's on Woodhaven Road in Northeast Philly, in the neighborhood that I grew up in, a church lot that I used to party in, down the street from the playground that I used to do other things at. And, you know, so he takes me to this meeting, and I think that you make, like, one AA meeting for your whole life. Like, you go to a meeting, and then, like, you just stay sober. Because I'm so self-consumed that I don't even know that my dad, I know my dad's an AA, but I kind of think he's a little crazy because I never saw him drink my whole life. So I don't know why he has to go to these meetings and stuff, right? And I also don't realize that he's going to these meetings 3 nights a week. My whole life. Like, I don't even realize that, because all I can worry about is me and what I'm doing and how I can get more, right? So he takes me to this meeting, and this girl who's only a couple years older than me at the time meets me outside, and she's like, are you Elena? And I was like, I don't know. That depends. Who are you, right? Because I'm, like, scared. I'm like, are you going to beat me up, right? I don't know. So she says, you know, no, I'm Maureen. Your uncle told, again, right, AA for me is a family disease. So your uncle told me you were going to be here. So we go to this meeting, and I automatically disqualify myself, right? There's a man up there, and he's speaking, and he's talking about how he lost, like, his family and his house and his job. And I'm like, I didn't lose any of that, because you had none of that to lose, you know? But I automatically was like, this is not for me. But I'll stay sober for a little bit and keep people, you know, like, off my back. So that Friday night, there used to be the sober club. It was called HP's on Tarzell Ave. And I went there after a meeting with some of the girls, took me there. And I remember I had so much fun. And I remember, like, laughing and feeling like I don't remember the last time that I laughed, right? That I, like, let my guard down and really, like, laughed, like, belly laughed. I also probably had, like, 20 shots of espresso that night. So I was like this. But I can remember, like, I went home and I said to my mom, I said, who's a saint? I said to her, I had so much fun and I didn't even, like, drink, right? Like, I don't know when the last time that it happened for me. Like, there was not a school dance that I went to sober. Like, if people didn't have something, I wasn't going. I wasn't going over people's houses to hang out. I was at softball kegs. Like, there was always everything that I did revolved. We were going to the movies. I was getting drunk beforehand, whether other people were or not. Like, there was nothing that I did that didn't revolve around drinking. So I remember saying, like, I haven't had fun like this in a long time. But like I said, I disqualified myself. And I learned later to look at, like, the similarities in people's stories and not the differences, right? We all get to that same point in our life where we feel that, like, powerlessness and that hopelessness, right? And then we can grow from there. So I couldn't relate, and, you know, I just wanted to do one more, right? Like, I was like, this time it's going to be different this time. I'm going to have 2 drinks, and I'm not even going to touch anything, and I'm going to go home. And I left the meeting, and I went somewhere. I had 2 drinks. And I came home 4 days later, and I just couldn't get it. And my life got worse, and I went in and out of rehabs and detoxes. in the meantime, and my life was insane. I put myself in terrible situations. You know, I'm 5'7". I was like 110 pounds, and I would walk down seeing Cambria and wait in an abandoned house like I belonged. Like, okay. You know, and just thinking about like that kind of, I won't even drive down there at noon. Like, windows locked, right? Like, everything. I'm scared. So, but at a time, I felt like I fit in there. And I continued to do this, and I continued to pop into AA, and I would think, like, maybe, like, my dad's friends will see me, and they'll be like, I saw Lena, she's doing so good, she looks great, right? But that didn't happen, and, you know, I just really felt like these were the cards I was dealt, and this is what my life was, right? And this is what was going to happen to me, and everybody should probably just get on board with it. So I was always allowed to come home if I would go away, right, if I would get sober. So I was down in Kensington one day, and my dad drove down with my brothers, and he said, come on, let's try this again, right, get in the car. And I remember I wanted to get in the car really bad, and I went to, like, put my hands on the door handle, and I heard somebody call my name from behind me, and I just looked at my dad. I just said, I'm sorry, like, not right now. And later that night, I caught myself in an empty storefront. And like I said, I'm 5'7". I was 108 pounds at the time. I had a black eye. And I thought I was looking really good. But I saw myself in that empty storefront, how everybody else saw me, for the first time in a long time. And I thought, you know what? Let me try this one more time. I got on the aisle. I went home. I walked in the door. And I did what I normally did, you know, like, you can get me a carton of Newports, you can pack my bag, I'm going to take a shower and brush my teeth, and, like, you can make some phone calls, and when I'm done, we can go somewhere. So I got out of the shower, and my dad said, nobody's taking you, right, you used up all your funding. I didn't even know that was, like, a thing. I'm so selfish, but, you know, I didn't even know that was a thing. So I said, okay, well, we can try that again, maybe, like, in a couple weeks, we'll try it again, and I went to leave, and my dad is 6'4", you know, 250 pounds, and he took my little tiny scrawny butt and said, you're not going anywhere, right, picked me up and detoxed me and kept me in a room for 3 days, and I owe that man my entire life, right? And I fought him. I kept trying to run out the door, and I'm trying to break down the door. It was a very ugly scene for those 3 days, and I never want to experience that again, and I didn't know if I was coming or going. I just wanted to stop hurting people, right? At that time, it wasn't even really about me. I felt bad that I was hurting so many people. So I went to a meeting. It was a Saturday morning meeting at King's Library. It was a meeting that I would go to sometimes when I was feeling, like, bad about myself, and I didn't raise my hand, and somebody called on me, and I do that today, but I remember that made me, like, so angry at the time, right? So I was like, my name's Alina, and I have, like, a couple days. I don't know if I'm coming or going, but I'm here right now, and a woman came up to me after the meeting, and she took down my phone number, and she called me, and for me, that was huge, because they talk about that phone weighing, like, 1,000 pounds, right? Like, I would never be picking up the phone and telling anybody that I need help. So she called me. I started talking to her, and I started, like, talking to her like I never talked to anybody. I would tell her the truth about what happens to me when I drink and what happens to me when I think I'm going to do just one, right? Like that one drink away from being a drunk, I couldn't understand that. One day at a time, like, all those things I couldn't understand, right, until I really got honest with myself and with somebody else about my disease. So I start making this meeting, and I'm not counting my time. I'm just making meetings. And if for me, it was about, like, repetition, right? So, like, Sundays I went to Christ the King. Mondays I went to Optus. Tuesday nights I didn't make a meeting in the beginning. It was all men's meetings in the Northeast. Wednesdays I went to First Three Steps. Thursdays Optus. Fridays King's Library. And Saturday Holy Family. And I just did that. I did that the same rotation for a year. And I just kept showing up, and you know, I couldn't hide anymore. Like, people would see me, and I had all these home groups, and, you know, if they were like, how are you? And I was like, fine. And I wasn't, they knew, right? Because I allowed people to get to know me. But I remember I was on the phone with a buddy of mine when I was getting sober. And, you know, it was like a phone that was connected to the wall. And I was sitting there and he was like, how long are you sober now? And I was like, I have no idea. And I counted it up and it was 30 days. And I felt like, oh my God, I have 30 days sober, right? Like it felt like a million years. Like how did I get 30 days sober? And for me, that was like the first time that I felt like maybe I can do this. Maybe I can give myself a chance, right? And stop disqualifying myself or comparing myself to everybody else and just maybe do this. So I just kept showing up. I had no intention of staying sober for any length of time. I just was going with the flow and I just did this. I just kept going every day and I started making friends. I started talking to women, right? A lot of times I know for me, like, and the women that I hang out with, we all had trouble with women in the beginning, right? Like it was like not people that we hung out with prior to getting sober, or maybe they were competition, or the reality is that you can't really lie to them that much, right? So I just surrounded myself with women. And I even remember when I went to that first woman's meeting at, it was in the coffee shop, the meeting that I go to now was in the Coffee Connection. I was on Frankfurt Ave in the basement and you smoked cigarettes there and there was zero ventilation. It was probably like two of those tables long. You didn't even have to light a cigarette. You could just breathe and it was like you were smoking. But it was such an awesome group of women. But even the first time I went there, I raised my hand and I said, I don't even like women, but my sponsor's making me come here, right? And they're like, okay, just keep coming back. So I did. I just kept showing up and my sobriety has been a ride. And I remember like walking into Octus to that first meeting I ever made that I still make today. I love that meeting. It feels like home to me. And there's this man there, his name's Joe Sinai, and he is just an angel. But he has the ability to make everybody feel like that's their home, right? You walk in there, he remembers your name. Hey, kiddo, come take a seat, right? He's amazing. And things that he has told me over the years play through my mind like a tape and have saved my ass a million times. And one of the things that he said was, hang on, kiddo, right? You're in for a ride. And he also told me things like unconditional sobriety, right? Staying sober under any and all conditions, car, no car, job, no job, house, no house, boyfriend, no boyfriend, right? All of that. And just like brainwashed, whatever, that's what plays in my mind at all times. And my sobriety has been a ride. I've had extreme highs and extreme lows. And I haven't found it necessary to pick up a drink. And, you know, so I get sober and I decide I'm going to go to hair school. And I go to hair school and I get perfect attendance, which is like amazing for somebody like me, right? I showed up every single day. And I remember being so proud like the first month. I'm like, I got perfect attendance for August, right? This is crazy. Taking it home to my mom and dad, like, here's an award. But feeling like just really like starting to feel that like pride, right, about yourself, like doing things for you and feeling the difference from being such a scared little girl, a scared broken little girl, right, to starting to become a woman. And, you know, at a few years sober, I was working on the main line cutting hair and my boss had bipolar and she didn't take medicine because it made her skin break out. So I never knew what I was walking into, right? She would maybe talk to me or maybe not talk to me for 4 weeks. Like, I was, like, the closest person to her. And I said, you know what, I don't think I can live like this anymore. I used to be smart. When I was in seventh grade, Johns Hopkins was doing a study, and they asked me to take the SATs. And I took the SATs, and I scored some astronomical scoring that, you know, people don't get when they're juniors and seniors. So I thought, like, maybe I used to be, you know, I used to be smart. Maybe I can do something. I like people. I'm good at math and science. Let me just go up to community and see what's up. So I went up there. I signed up for some classes. 4 years later, I became a registered nurse. And In the meantime, I had opened up a barbershop, and I owned and operated a barbershop for 6 years as well, and I nursed at the same time. And I ended up selling that barbershop because I got a nursing promotion, right, because God works in my life, and I turn everything over to Him, and, you know, He saw fit for me to go and do nursing full-time. But, you know, at 7 years sober, I found out that I was sick, and, you know, I got diagnosed with cancer, and I was going to doctors, and my sponsor at the time came with me. She came with me every step of the way, and I remember we're, like, in one of my doctor's appointments, and the doctor's like, "Do you still smoke?" And she's like, "Didn't you hear her? She doesn't drink alcohol, right?" Like, that should be, like, just, like, a gateway for me to do, like, anything else that I wanted, right? I'm like, I smoke Newport Lights now instead of regular Newport, right? But I just kept showing up, and I remember getting sick and everybody around me being crazy, even my dad, right, because I'm his daughter, and so scared. And I had worked on this relationship with God, because one of the things that Joe said to me as well was that there's going to come a time in your sobriety where the only thing that stands between you and a drink is God, so you better make sure that you're on good spiritual grounds at all times. And I did that, right? I just kept praying, and I started off talking to God like He was my friend. I would just be driving in the car, and I'd be like, "Hey, God," right, and just have these conversations. Like, I was just, like, comfortable, and this faith and this reliance, right, upon God has carried me through my sobriety. But so I'm sick, they tell me I can't have any kids, and you know, it's awful. It's a terrible time in my life, and I listen to the doctors and I stay positive and I keep it moving, and I smoke Newport Lights instead of Newports, and I'm doing all the right things, and I get a surgery, and I go back 6 months later, right, and they tell me that everything's gone, and I keep going, and today, you know, I'm 13 years with nothing, and to me, like, that's a miracle. So I'm doing that, and I'm working, and I'm nursing, and I'm cutting hair, and I'm doing my treatments, and I'm making my women's meetings, and I'm sponsoring girls, and I meet a guy in AA, and there's a red flag before I even meet him, right? But I, like, historically, I like to really ignore red flags because I like to fix people, and I'm going to, like, show you a different way how to live, right? Like, "You've never been to Del Frisco's downtown? Okay, we'll go there," right? Like, I feel like I need to be, like, the person. So I meet this guy, and we're really good friends, and we decide that we get married, right? And we get married, and I get pregnant, and, you know, nobody thinks this is ever going to happen. So I get pregnant, and I'm so happy, and we buy a house over in New Jersey, and I have, disclosure, I have a beautiful 6-year-old healthy daughter. So I get pregnant, and and I go to my ultrasounds, and I'm high risk. So I'm getting doctor's appointments, ultrasounds, you know, a million, and I'm just praying the whole time. A friend of mine who I got sober with, he stayed sober for 13 years, and he had picked up, and he couldn't get back to AA, right? He kept trying, and he just couldn't get back here. He couldn't let everything go. And he decides that that his best way, right, to deal with it at that time is to put a gun in his mouth. And I was so devastated, right? He was such a big part of my early sobriety. And, you know, so we're going, we leave the mass for his funeral, and we're driving to the cemetery, and my doctor calls me, and she says that my baby has holes in her brain, and that I had opted out of any genetic testing in the beginning of my pregnancy. And she said, "I really need you to get the genetic testing done now, because I need to be prepared if I'm delivering a stillborn." And I said, "Okay, doctor, no problem." And I hung up the phone, and I just, the sound that came out was like someone else was screaming, right? And I remember just getting to the cemetery and leaving there and calling my sponsor and telling her what was going on. And her and I praying and just really just feeling centered, going the next day, getting the testing done and just all of it. And I had to get ultrasounded, you know, twice a week. And they kept showing these holes in my baby's brain, and I just kept praying and I just kept talking about it. And I said, okay, if this is God's will, like I'm going to, as much as this sucks, I'm going to really teach somebody about this, right? If someone, I'm going to be able to help someone, because that's another thing that I've learned in AI is that everything that I've gone through, really good things or really terrible things, I've been able to help somebody through it, as painful as that is, right? So I'm going to these ultrasounds and, you know, and there's still all these holes. And at 32 weeks, I get a call that there's no holes in my baby's brain. And nobody knows how that happened, right? But it happened. They closed up. And, you know, I give birth to this baby 4 weeks early, and she's sick and I'm sick and she's in the NICU. And, you know, I have an extended hospital stay. I end up having a stroke in the hospital because my blood pressure is insane. I gained 100 pounds of just fluid in my last 2 months of my pregnancy. I couldn't even walk. So I'm in there, and then I get discharged and my baby stays in the hospital. And I get home, and for me, my alcoholism comes at me in many different ways, right? It's not always alcohol. It's not always drugs. Sometimes it's like kill yourself, right? Like, or you're less than that person, like whatever. It's always something going on in my mind, right? Because my disease center's in here, so it tries to get me wherever it can. And I come home from the hospital, and I come home to this beautiful house that I bought for, you know, to bring a baby home, and it's all decorated with baby stuff, and I have no baby, and my head says, you're a fake mom, you know, all of these crazy things that I know are not true at that time, but also your hormones are insane. And it says you should just put a gun in your mouth. And it just keeps saying that. And because I have this program, right, and I have this relationship with God and I have all these support people, I called up a woman and I said, hey, this is what's going on. Can you come stay here with me? And she showed up and stayed there, right? And I had so many women there that walked me through this experience. And then I was able to come home with a beautiful, healthy child who was so smart and sweet. And really just like a total gift from God, a miracle baby. And, you know, so it was a very rough year for me. I had this sick baby, and my friend had killed himself. And then I got a call that my cousin was hanging. He was one of us. He didn't want to admit it. And instead, he thought that he should hang himself instead of reaching out for help. We called him the golden child, right? We thought he was the only one that wasn't like us, and he had a college degree and, you know, all this stuff. And I can remember getting the call, you need to get to Darby's house, Kevin's hanging, right? And running over there and driving home from there and being mad at God, right? Being mad, thinking like, I help all these strangers and I can't even help my family, right? Like all those kinds of things in my mind. And then 2 weeks after that, a friend of ours that also was sober a long time had picked up, and he jumped out a window and killed himself. And 2 weeks after that, I found out that my husband was no longer sober and had been having an affair for the past year. So my mind said, you know, why don't you get a box of wine, right? Some classy. I'm going to get a box of wine and a carton of Newport. And I'm just going to sit in my room, and any doctor will give me a script of Xanax, absolutely, right now. So instead, right, I called my sponsor, and there's no coincidences in AA. At 15 years sober, my sponsor's husband left her for another woman and left her as a single mom to a small girl. And my sponsor is a light, and I asked her, you know, how do you continue to be so positive and not bitter, right? Because I have an aunt who went through a similar situation, and she is a miserable bitch. And, you know, I was so afraid that I was going to be like Aunt Pat, and I didn't want to. So I was like, how do I do this, right? And that's when my sponsor taught me about being open and vulnerable, right? And continuing to show up and continuing to be a light and continuing to share my experience, strength, and hope with people. And not get a box of wine and a bottle of Xanny's, right? So I showed up and I went to meetings and I made so many meetings and I sponsored so many women during this time that it was like, I don't even know how, and raised a little baby, right, by myself, and sold a house and got divorced and, you know, everything. And, you know, if I were to try to do that today, I don't even know where all the puzzle pieces fit. But God found time for me during that period, right, to be able to do that. So, again, I was able to share all of those experiences with other women in AA. And I remember my sponsor, when I was going through that, saying to me, like, I knew I was going to help somebody. I really hate that it's you, right? And I have said that to other women, right, in my sobriety, too. And, you know, I know how you're feeling. I hate that you're feeling this way, but I do know it, and I know that you can come out the other side. And I have never become bitter. I forgave him. I forgave him, you know, way before he asked for my forgiveness, right? I love him like he's a friend. He would tell you that I'm his best friend. I'm like a keep your enemies closer kind of girl, right, with that one. But, you know, he wants to be best dad friends with Mike. Those are actually his words, right? But there's like a, you know, a peace that I have. And, like, I can remember feeling like, why me, right? Like, when you, like, I did A, B, and C. Why is Z happening? Like, where's this left field coming from, right? Like, if I do everything this right way and I'm sober and I'm a nice woman, like, why is all these horrible things happen, right? Like, that God does not promise you that you're going to get sober and that your life is going to be like peaches, right? Like, he promises you, or AA promises you, that if you show up here and you follow these suggestions and you practice this program and you get a relationship with God, that you don't have to pick up a drink, right? There's nothing that's going to make you pick up a drink, and anything else that comes along is a bonus. And my life today is beautiful, and I have always had that faith that God was going to pull me through to the other side. And I remember saying, like, I'm not going to date anybody until Ruby's 18. You know, you set these, like, you know, milestones for yourself. It's just going to be me and her for the next 18 years. And that would have been awful. I would have been such a more smothering than I already am. But, you know, and I'm just going to focus on just me and everything. And about a year and a half later, I was like, maybe I want to date somebody. So people had told me for years to, like, make a list of, like, non-negotiables, right, in a partner, and not just like a dude, but like a partner, right? And I remember I had the right things on there that, like, might be common sense for some people, but not for me. Like, for me, I had to write down, like, driver's license, has a job, maybe has their own place, like, knows how to pay a bill. Like, that kind of stuff, because I'll overlook that. I'll be, I have a house. I got a car. Like, I got money. Like, come, you can live with me. It's fine, right? So I had to really, like, take a look at that and not date the same person with a different face or a different name, right? So when people would be reaching out to me, or, you know, now I'm, like, older, so they're, like, inboxing. I'm like, why are you inboxing me? This is weird. I just saw you at a meeting. You didn't say one word to me. And then I get home and there's an inbox. So I had to really, like, anytime somebody asked me to go out, I would, like, look at this list and I would, like, be like, no, nope, nope. So then my girlfriend had set up a Bumble account. Well, that's a lie. I made her a Bumble account sitting on my couch. And we were on there and we started talking to, like, the same people and stuff. And then I saw my husband on there and I was like, wait, I know him. And this is how God works. A couple months before that, a girl was over at my house getting her hair done, and she was like, you should go out with Mike White. And I was like, I don't even know him like that. Like, no. And didn't he go out with that other girl? She's crazy. Right? And then I was like, maybe I shouldn't judge people in their past relationships because my husband was crazy. So it was already planted in my head. So I had swiped on him, and then we had, you know, he met all of those things on my list, and I was open and I was vulnerable, and I knew with 100% that God had placed him in my life and that it was right from the start. And you know, we got married last October, and that was another thing I was not going to do. I was never going to get married, right? They say, like, insanity is doing the same things over and over again, expecting different results. But this felt right, so I got married again. And we raised our children together. You know, we have a 9-year-old who's my stepdaughter, whose mom has passed away. And I get to be able to be there and try to be a mom for her. It's been a challenge, right? Raising, being a stepmother for me is a challenge, something that I work on every day. But I have the opportunity to be able to change somebody's life, right, by being a mother figure to them. And our life is amazing, and it's because we both work in AA program, we both have faith in God, and we practice morals and values in our everyday life. I think about, like, my parents, right, and how I had robbed them of not just money, right? They used to run the CYO at St. Martha's, and they had this, like, big St. Patrick's Day party every year where they made all this money. I would just dip my hand in there. As soon as everybody went to sleep that night, I was opening it up, taking money. You know, whatever I could ever get my hands on, I would take. But most of all, I know they don't care about that kind of stuff, right? They care about the sleepless nights, right, and the heartache of knowing that their daughter is in an unsafe place and that they may get a call that she's dead at any moment, right? And my mom had told me before I got sober that I was a drug addict, waste of life. And she tells me a million times over how much she loves me and she's proud of me. She tells me that I make her want to be a better person, right? Like, these are the kinds of rewards that I'm able to receive just by being sober and just by doing this work. And, you know, I work this job. I'm a hospice nurse, and, you know, I'll get cornier for a second, but, you know, there's no way that I can get closer to God than being there, right? Like, at the moment that someone takes their last breath, like, for me, it's a gift and a privilege to be able to perform that kind of end-of-life care and to be able to be there. I also have, you know, given morphine to patients over and over again. That's a big hospice med. And I know that if I'm not sober, like, they're getting water, right? Like, that's the reality of my disease. And I get to be there, and I don't even think about it like that at all. And I've been working in this for this company for 8.5 years, and I got a huge promotion in October where I'm in charge of the entire state of New Jersey, their hospice. And they trust me to run, this national company trusts me to run their biggest money, their biggest profitable area, right? And it's amazing. And I used to think, like, people are going to find out, like, what are they going to find out? That I live a really good, clean life, right? And, you know, I'll end with this, but I remember, like, going to office, and this guy, he would raise his hand, and he would say my name. He would say his name, and he would say that his life's beyond his wildest dreams. And I can remember just, like, throwing myself back and being like, it's Thursday night, we're in an AA meeting, this sucks, like, my life's over. And, like, my wildest dreams at that time was, like, to get a house one day at, like, Emerald and Somerset and raise my kids there. It would be, like, convenient, and I would have, like, a poster in the basement of, like, Jimi Hendrix. I don't even know who that is, but I thought it was cool. And just, like, that was, like, my wildest dreams. And if I would have got what I wanted, I surely would have sold myself short. Thanks, guys.